Here's a little something for you to chew on. I've been dwelling on the Amon brothers a lot, and it turns out that what they had was Tesla's trimetal generator. That's, you know, we don't know anything about Tesla's trimetal generator except it's made of three metals: copper, aluminum, and iron. And we also know that William Lyne, and I'm going to get to that in a minute, talks about it. I believe it's in his book Pentagon Aliens, chapter 8 or 18, you know. So what happened was, I don't know how to attack this. There's so many different things to say here. All right. So historically, let's go back into the history. 1895. Tesla has a fire in his laboratory, and I believe that it is a cover-up to hide the theft that took place, because immediately Carl Linde of Germany, L-I-N-D-E, patented the liquefaction of air, the very same process that Tesla had been working on in his lab. Now, that was 50 years prior, more or less, 45, to World War II. And this is when a lot of the technology that was stolen from the lab at that time that Tesla was working on was utilized by, or developed over the course of half a century, by the Germans, and then gradually brought into the war effort. But they didn't bring it in soon enough because we won the war. Otherwise, if we hadn't, as General Patton has exclaimed, if we had waited 3 weeks to invade the beaches of Normandy, it would have been a totally different outcome, because they found these, covert assembly lines in which all sorts of new technology of armaments and whatnot, vehicles and whatnot, were in development, but they hadn't come out yet. And so if we had waited, he said it would have taken much longer to win the war. It would have dragged on for years. No, actually, he didn't say, I don't think he said when. He just said it would drag on for more years because the technology was fantastic. But, you know, the Germans were working with what they stole, and so they didn't really have Tesla to guide them through it. Now, William Lyne tells us that he liked to go to junkyards to get stuff, and he found all kinds of old equipment that came out of flying saucer, the early flying saucer development by the Army in New Mexico around the time of after World War II. Well, he met up with a guy in charge of one of the junkyards called Dort, D-O-R-T, and he said that his father had helped the Germans develop their use of Tesla's special generator, which was one of the things that was in the lab at the time of the fire and was destroyed, to implement it in a small amount of their electro U-boats to make them very long range. So now an electro U-boat runs off of DC. They have batteries, they have a DC motor, and then they have a diesel fired engine to run a generator. They have to come up to the surface to burn the diesel in order to recharge their batteries, and that can create problems, right? You're a sitting duck, putting out smoke, no less. If they had infrared, you know, they would have detected the heat. But be that as at the time, but I'm sure they didn't, but be that as it may. So this special line of U-boats had a minimum of 30,000 miles range, and in some cases unlimited. It depends on the situation, because the Tesla special generator, as documented by Thomas Comerford Martin in his book, see, this is why I think there was a fire, because Thomas went through and really methodically listed all of the technologies up to that era that were very novel, and the special generator was the last one in the last chapter of that book. And so I'm sure that the Germans just drooled and said, hey, we got to go fetch it from his lab and destroy the evidence. But now, because Thomas was given a lecture by Tesla, a presentation, in the agricultural building of the World's Fair, I believe it was in Chicago, in 1893. And then he came out with his book describing that lecture in 1894, and then the fire was in 1895. So it kind of makes sense to speculate what has happened. It is a pretty good chance that it's accurate, but it's all speculation, but it's still, it's a guess estimate. We call it a guess estimation. What's your best estimation? Well, I think that's it. So they needed help to work on the special generator. The special generator was a fascinating device. It was a mechanical device. It ran on compressed air, but the air was stored in liquid form in canisters, and that's why Tesla, one of the inventions that went with the special generator was the liquefaction of air. In any case, the piston that was driven by this compressed air was like the reed in a wind instrument, a musical instrument, like, a clarinet, an oboe, because unlike a trumpet where you can purse your lips, you can change your pressure to change the tune, and also on a flute, you know, you change how you direct the air into the holes. Unlike that, in a reed instrument, wind instrument, the pitch never changes because the reed is there to keep the pitch the same. And so all you can do is your fingering. So with a flute, you can do fingering, you can do blowing different things and whatnot. But with a reed instrument, you can't. Like a clarinet, it's a single pitch, and all you can do is finger it to change the pitch. Finger the holes, you know, stop up the open holes. And select which ones you open or close with your fingers. So that's the way this piston worked. Because to Tesla, it was crucial that the pitch, and he ran it at 80 cycles per second, never varies, and it had to be exactly the same all the time. Why? Because this device had two massive horseshoe iron cores that had humongous winding, like 50 miles of winding, William Lyon said. That's why he gave up once the fire happened. He never pursued that any further. But the two horseshoe cores were bolted to the floor of the charging room, the battery room of the Electra U-boat, to enhance the power gain by making use of the iron of the hull. And this is where William Lyon quotes Nikola Tesla as claiming that for every 200 pounds of iron added to his special generator, 1 horsepower was increased at the output. So iron was important, and I'm going to get to that in a minute, why it is. So that was the special generator. Well, there's this rumor or story about Tesla's tri-metal generator, and it turns out, this is where Dort comes into the picture, it's not the special generator. It's a different device, but there's only all we have are stories. And when I was when I had an electric car in running order at one point, I was living somewhere that I needed to have a charging port, a charging outlet installed. I think it's 240 volt, 30 amp. You know, like an RV charging. So. So the electrician who installed it was a real Tesla fan. He had one of the editions of Tesla's Colorado Springs notes, and he actually lent them to me to look over, you know, and it was very interesting how Tesla made capacitors, you know, in Colorado Springs. It was a bank of capacitors. It was very interesting. Anyway, so he told me about this guy he had met 10 years prior. Now, this story, this electrician was almost 10 years ago. So this is like 20 years ago that this electrician knew this guy in, I think it was Kansas. And he was a fellow worker, you know, associate, another electrician. But he had what he claimed was Tesla's special, no, excuse me, He had a device that was the shape and size of a notebook, and it powered an electric motor. He gave a demonstration. And so he and his wife became very curious, and they invited him over for dinner, and they asked him, okay. They tried to pry out of him, you know. And, he kept his mouth shut, except he said one thing. It makes use of the three metals of copper, aluminum, and iron. So this is, I know it exists, even though Jim Murray told me it's a rumor, don't believe it. But I know it exists because I have an eyewitness, all right? So I know it's valid. The trouble is we don't know anything about it. But we do know something about the Amon brothers. And there are some things, I must admit, that I think his name is Patrick Kelly. He has a website, freeenergy.co.uk, you know. And he has another one for .com. And he does have a device in there that kind of looks like it's Tesla's tri-metal generator. You know, it's got pancake coils and plates. But I didn't really get it. I didn't understand how the thing is built. So now I know how it's built. But the reason for this recording is that Dort Jr. told William Lyne that iron is the magnetic, copper is the active, and aluminum is the reflector or reflective. And, you know, it's kind of cryptic, you know. Is it a special coded language? Well, yeah, it is. See, I didn't think it was. Some of it is. But we have to interpret it anyway. So it is coded. Magnetic means real power. There's no such thing as real power. It's a fiction. Just like current is a fiction, so is real power. What we call real power is an approximation of what we like to idealistically think is real power. But it's actually a blend of two reactances, electrical reactances, capacitive and inductive, in a framework of time. And we can write it on paper that real power exists as an entity, just like we can write on paper that current is an entity that exists, but neither one exists. They're both fictions. Current is a mathematical shorthand for a change in reactive, the change that occurs because reactive voltage must change over time due to impedance. And applied voltage does not. Applied voltage is electrostatic voltage, pressure, whatever, what we think of it. But reactive voltage does not. Reactive voltage must change all the time. It can never remain constant. And it's those two voltages divided by resistance that is the only version of Ohm's law I subscribe to. Anything else is a fiction for one purpose or reason or another, because it doesn't teach you. Those versions don't teach you anything. They're great, you know, for whatever purpose you are using them for as a technician, right? But if you're trying to learn the theory, it's hopeless. You won't learn a damn thing, because current does not exist. Current is a shorthand notation which replaces something more complicated called reactive voltage, divided by impedance over within a context of time. That's what current means, and that's a little, you know. So they simplified it to make the technician's job easier. That's all they want to churn out in electrical engineering is a bunch of technicians. They don't want you to really understand it, because if you did, you'd come up with free energy devices, and you'd know it's a charade and a sham that they lie about it. Anyway. So current is a fiction, all right, because it represents something more complicated that is not a fiction. Well, it turns out that real power is a fiction as well, because there's no such thing as a perfect vacuum, right? Well, there's no such thing as a perfect real power, you know, perfect unity power factor is what the qualification of real power amounts to. Even a piece of wire in a DC circuit is a reactant element, because it has capacitance, because it has insulation covering it, and it has inductance because it has length. Even if we don't coil it, it still has inductance. So already we've got the two reactances that makes up the ingredients of electricity right there in a piece of wire. Any piece of wire. All right? So This is where I get my aha moment, because when Dort Jr. told William Lyne that copper is the active element of those three elements of Tesla's trimetal generator, what he was really saying was what is what we call reactive. What he called active, we call reactive. And this is important because electricity comes from what we call reactants. Reactants does not, it's true, electricity stimulates reactants, that's true. But electricity is a composition of ingredients, and none of them are electricity. They're both reactances all the time. It's always this way. Those are the two ingredients of electricity. Capacitive reactants, inductive reactants, in a context of time. Three ingredients, but two that, you know, we deal with. You know, voltage, we measure current, you know. Two things, okay. So copper is the active element because it's the only substance that harbors and encourages and embodies reactants to a very high degree, and so that's why we use it, because it's reactive, or what Dort Jr. called active, because it is. Reactive power is extremely active in the sense that it's dynamic and it's constantly changing and it can never be the same, you know, from one point of time to the next. In other words, getting back to our simple piece of wire now, it's not a question of energy in equals energy out. It's a question of energy in can never equal reactants out, because reactants can never equal anything. It's constantly changing. It's so active that it cannot stay the same. It's very dynamic. And that's where power comes from. It comes from that active component that we call reactants that is what Dort Jr. was referring to when he said copper is the active, because it harbors it, it encourages it, okay? So where can we hang our hat? We hang it on iron, because iron is the magnetic. But if you take away the power that you're giving to, let's say, a solenoid coil, right? It's got an iron core and a copper winding. If you take the power away, and it was a DC power, and let's say you just gave it a snap, you know, just an instant of power, snap switch, just a little spark of a DC power to that iron core will orient itself a certain way based on what the orientation of the electromagnetic field generated by the coil was. There will be an impression, a footprint made in that iron that will never change. It'll remain in perpetuity, unless and until it becomes demagnetized and remagnetized in a different direction, or in the same direction. But in any case, if it's demagnetized and remagnetized in any direction, that's the only time that perpetual motion will stop. And it's called magnetic remanence, and it was used in computer core memory dating between the years of 1955 and 1975. It's part and parcel to Edward Lee Skolnin's popularization. He didn't discover it, but he popularized the perpetual motion holder experiment, where you take an iron rebar and you bend it into a horseshoe and you sand the bottom feet to make it smooth, and you get a nice smooth metal plate to go across it, and you hold it there, and you have coils surrounding either one or both legs of the horseshoe, but they have to be in the same direction in the sense of a toroid. So the left one will look flipped from the right one, but from the perspective of that toroidal magnetic loop, you know, the horseshoe and the iron bar at the bottom, at the feet of the horseshoe, from the toroidal point of view, the coils have to have the same direction, because you're setting up a DC charge that you're putting into the iron material of that constructs the rebar that you bent and the plate on the bottom that connects the feet to create a toroidal connection, a magnetic toroidal connection. And so you're going to get a magnetic remanence in there in one direction or the other, and that's how computer core memory worked in those 20-year period. And it doesn't work in modern-day transformers for the simple reason that the core material of a modern-day transformer is not designed to retain any magnetic remnants. They don't want... See, they claim they don't want eddy currents, but in the course of getting rid of eddy currents by using a composition, kind of like particle board, you know, you get a sheet of particle board 4 feet wide or 6 feet long or something, whatever it is, 8 feet long. Yeah, for walls. You put it in buildings. And it's compressed sawdust, basically, with glue to hold it together. Well, that's how they make modern-day AC transformers. And they're very friable. It's very easy to break them. You can take your two hands and break them. But if you try to use it as part of a perpetual motion holder experiment, it won't work. The minute you take the power away, the magnetic remnants winks out like a switch, turned it off immediately. So it doesn't retain any magnetic remnants, any memory of the magnetic flow and the orientation that you imparted to it. And so all you get out of an AC transformer is the change of phase in between each half cycle. When it changes direction, the alternating current changes direction, or I should say the alternating voltage, because it's funny, we call it alternating current, AC, but it's really alternating voltage. It should be AV. Anyway, when it switches over to the opposite direction, that's the only time you get a surge, a pulse, and that's the only time you get power transferred from the primary to the secondary of a transformer, because nobody builds it the way Nathan Stubblefield built his transformer, based on the work of Oliver Heaviside, you know, his solution to the transatlantic telegraph cable problem of the 1800s, they used iron. See, Heaviside suggested to put iron dust in the insulation of the copper cable, and they found a more efficient way was to take permalloy and wrap it. It's like a magnetic tape, like VHS tape. Wrap it around the copper core, then put a very humongously thick insulation on top of that. And that became the new telegraph cable. And amazingly, it worked, because they were getting distortion because the magnetic field could not keep up with the electric field, the dielectric field, the electrostatic field. Because copper carries the electrostatic field very readily. Because remember, you apply electrostatics to the outside of the terminals of the thing, and then you get a reactive voltage. And that's the electrostatic field, the electric field. And so that's why copper is called the active, because it's reactive. But it's no good for carrying current, because current we want to be constant. And because current comes from magnetism, magnetism comes from current, but magnetism, like in a permanent magnet, is constant. And you know, it slowly deteriorates over time, but it's constant, more or less. And so, and it only deteriorates because it gets all mixed up and confused inside. The energy, the magnetic energy inside of a magnetizable piece of iron is always there. All we do is reorient the domains, you know, the crystal lattice domains, so that each domain, the magnetic field, points in the same direction as its neighbor. And then we see, aha, north is here on this end and south is on the other end. But all those dipoles are there all the time. Talk about perpetual motion. So iron always has perpetual motion going on inside of it, and that is constancy, and that is the only source of current and real power, because you can bank on it. It's always there. All you have to do is make use of it. So this is the consequence of calling iron the magnetic. It's the only source for real power, and it's the reason why it counterpoises, or you know, it in contradistinction to copper, which is the active, because it's the reactive. It's constantly changing all the time and never stays the same. Now, there's another little tidbit here, and that is that copper is considered to be diamagnetic, while iron is considered to be magnetic, or excuse me, ferromagnetic, although there are other variations of ferromagnetic I'm learning, ferrimagnetic and anti-ferrimagnetic. Be that as it may, let's just stick with the simple one that we all know about, ferromagnetic. And then aluminum embodies the principle of paramagnetism, in which it wants to export its magnetism. It doesn't want... See, iron wants to concentrate it. That's why it has magnetic remnants, because it wants to concentrate magnetism inside of itself, which is current, basically. And it's real power. But aluminum does the opposite. It wants to export. It wants to get rid of it. You try to put a magnetic field onto aluminum and says, hey, I don't want this, and it shoots it right back at you. And that's why it's used in the material of the parabolic dishes for various antennas or whatnot, because it's highly reflective of the magnetic component of electricity. So, when we get to Tesla's trimetal generator, this is why it's important to use all those three elements, because we need all of them in an integrated fashion to get the job done. Now, I'm not going to tell you how it's built, but I already gave you some hints, and I've given you a lot already. Let's put it that way. It's a fascinating thing, because I'm going to give you one more hint. When it's properly fashioned, without the help of a spark gap or a gas discharge tube or anything else that is what we consider to be a negative resistance component that can generate negative resistance, this trimetal generator of Tesla, Nikola Tesla, actually generates negative resistance. And it's because the aluminum and the iron bounce back and forth. The energy bounces back and forth between the two. The iron is busy becoming magnetized, but the aluminum doesn't want it. It doesn't want the magnetic field, so it shoots it. It echoes it. It reverberates it back to the iron. And if you put the copper in between, then you've got yourself a sandwich. Now, I'm still not telling you how to construct it, but be that as it may, that's pretty much all the elements of construction anyway. I mean, actually, I didn't keep anything a secret. Look at that. I just blabbled. Nobody listens to my audio recordings anyway to speak of. So, you know, I don't mind giving it away. But anyway, there is one other element left remaining. And the component. There's one component missing. And I always suspected it. It had something to do with silica, because silica is a dielectric. So that, see, there, I just gave it away. What component is missing? But how do you fashion it, see? How do you arrange all these components so that it's the simplest, most efficient arrangement possible? And I've had my suspicions all along. You know, what was in that 2-foot-long, 1-foot-square wooden project box of Nikola Tesla that he put on the car seat, the bench seat, to his immediate right on the front bench seat next to him, that powered his Pierce Arrow demonstration of 1931. You know, what was in there? Well, I think he changed what I just described to you, how it's built, because I think what he did was he used vacuum tube capacitors in place of some of the components of the system to improve efficiency, because he needed a lot of power to power, you know, a Pierce Arrow of that era weighs over 4,000 pounds. And in order to achieve 90 miles per hour within a reasonable length of time of acceleration, you got to have a lot of power, a lot of magnetic force, because that's always the weak link in every circuit, over unity circuitous in particular, is the magnetic field. Because that's what wants to dissipate ever so quickly, as they found out with the transatlantic telegraph cable problem. So, if you can handle that, the magnetism, then you can handle pretty much anything. But it's what you do with the magnetism that makes all the difference. Because voltage is easy. Anybody can deal with voltage. Tesla coil of a modern era, not the type that Nikola built, but our modern so-called Tesla coils, all they do is put out voltage. Big, huge sparks. So that's easy. Everybody knows how easy that is. or they should. I've certainly learned when I do over unity simulations, that's the easiest thing to produce, and it's very hard to produce a current. But I'm beginning to understand why, and what does it take to create current? It takes negative resistance, but it has to be consistent. You can't rely on a gas discharge tube. You know, you got to break down the volt. You got to have a breakdown voltage point, and it's intermittent. And a spark gap is chaotic. Talk about pure chaos. You never know from 1 minute to the next what the damn thing's going to do. So it's not consistent. We need power, real power. You know, current based on magnetism has to be consistent to be viable in our world. So I think I've given you a lot of stuff. And it stands to reason that it's really no longer a mystery anymore. Because I know the nomenclature that Dort Jr. was using, what it means. I thought I knew what he meant when he said active, but I really did not know. I understood aluminum, you know, was reflective because it's paramagnetic, but that's the real kicker, you know, finding out that the activity, the dynamic quality of copper is its reactance, its ability to react. One more thing. Triangular waves indicate non-saturation of an inductor, but they also indicate something else. The echo that I described, the bouncing back and forth of a negative resistance, that's what a triangle wave is exemplifying. An echo. A periodic echo. That's why it's so sharp and not like a sine wave, because it's bouncing off of something and coming back at you. Actually, in the case of the rock face, that's what comes back at you. But in the case of the electricity, it bounces between positive and negative polarization of charge. On top of which, the current and the voltage are out of phase by a whole half cycle, by a complete half cycle. So, and yet, each of those are displaced from positive unity power factor by a full 90 degrees. So that they have 180 degrees between them, but they're both zero power factor. They're both 0 watts. So the outcome is still 0 watts because the current cancels the voltage. But it is reactive power, and it can be converted into real power. So it's not useless. It's the generation of free energy, basically. Now, I know some of you are thinking simulators are worthless because all they do is crunch numbers. They're mathematical instruments. But I'll have you know that the brain is the best instrument of all because it does not just calculate. It also inspires, imagines, intuits, and remembers. And it's for this reason that I use a simulator, to train my mind to become a simulator. I'll never be like Tesla. I don't have photographic memory, can't remember a damn thing from 1 minute to the next. But by spending countless hours in front of various simulators, I train myself on how to be able to make up for what's missing in those simulators, namely the experience of doing experimentation. But Tesla never did that. He wasn't like Edison. He simulated it in his brain. And only when he was confident that it would work would he tell a lab assistant how to build it, and it worked the first time every time. So, this is the reason why I use simulators. So don't get hung up on the mathematics tendency of simulators, you know, to crunch numbers and maybe give you inaccurate results. That's not important. Eventually, with enough training, you can see through all of the shortcomings of a simulator and eventually appreciate its assets, its strong points, because every simulator is different. They're not realistic, we all know this, and they have a different slant depending on the author of that simulator, what presumption was going on in their brain, whether they were conscientious of it or not. You know, Paul Falstead's simulator is great for teaching us magnetic remanence, because it can pass DC. But the Berkeley Spice family of simulators, knockoffs, you know, like Healthy Spice and MicroCap, can't do that. They can't. They don't have it built in. You have to make it happen artificially. Understanding why you can get away with it as a representational model, not as a model, it's not a model of the real world. It's a representational model of the real world. So you have to interpret the simulation. And the only way you can do that is because you have to become a simulator. You have to assimilate what the simulator does to such a degree that it becomes your nature. It becomes your brain. You know, neuroscientists know that when you train a subject to do a task over and over again, it builds connections in the brain, and the connections become more and more numerous, strengthening that habit pattern. So that's what I do. Now, that does lock me in, that's true. And it is a shortcoming, that's true. But just think of the benefit. My learning curve is humongous, you know, because I get to rapidly reassemble a circuit. Doesn't cost me anything, can't get electrocuted. And so it's the best way, as far as I'm concerned, the best way to learn. But you have to see it with a broad brush. We can't look at it like a scientist would look at it and say, ah, hogwash, you know? You got to look at it like an artist. My mom was an artist. And as much as I like to dwell on science, I look at it with an artistic flair, with an artistic perspective. Sorry for the noise, I'm driving. And consequently, that gives me some advantages that normal scientists don't have, because they have such a narrow tunnel vision. They have such a narrow focus. It's great for focusing, but it doesn't really help them take in the big picture. You've got to be somewhat of an artist to be able to take in the big picture and come up with stuff on pure inspiration, because that's the way artists work. And that's the way I work. I work on inspiration. Only after the fact do I analyze what my experience gave me. But I don't analyze the intuition. That's a waste of time. I use the intuition or the inspiration to give me an incentive to try out something on the simulator. And whether or not I come up with a free energy circuit, even though that's the goal, that's the purpose, that doesn't mean I come up with one. All I come up with are, for the most part, are demonstrations or exercises. I come up with exercises in thinking, on how to think, but not using the intellect or the intention to think a certain way, but a reflex. I'm building reflexes. It becomes reflexive for me. And then with the help of analysis and thought and inspiration and intuition and imagination, I can start to go beyond what the simulator can offer me and give myself something more than what the simulator can offer me. I can give myself a kind of training that the simulator can't provide, and certainly formal education in that field of electrical engineering cannot provide either. Because when I look at simulators, I see the corporate incentive. They are designed to push a product and a way of thinking. And outside of that box, the simulator can't provide you. You have to make up the difference. Your brain has to become a simulator and make up the difference. And that's what I've trained myself to do. Or else I wouldn't be able to do what I do. Okay, is that a little clearer? So you can't take the simulations seriously. They're an exercise, just like you do jumping jacks, you know, or a jump rope, you know. Kirk Douglas, in one of his movies, Tough Guys with Burt Lancaster, He showed off his jump rope skills. It's phenomenal. That guy was old. And he could do what he could do with a jump rope. I don't even want to try. So, you know, when you train yourself, you're able to do various interesting skills that you couldn't have done otherwise. And so learning about electrodynamic theory is all very well and good when you go into the classroom, but it's really training that is what is needed. And I got my training first. I got my understanding only after the fact of having experiences to analyze and then look and see what do electrical engineers or other engineers have to say. Initially, I went to optical engineers because they seemed to have the only knowledge that was valid. But then I started learning about Eric Dollard, you know, and oh, well, that's a little easier to understand than the terminology of optical engineering. My God, that's like Greek or something. It's very obtuse, shall we say, unless you're a professional, right? And I'm not. So I had a turn to electrical engineers and whatnot who were gifted in breaking it down to a layperson's, you know, mentality, me. So I could, but it's the training, though. The training is all important. The understanding is icing on the cake. It's the training that matters, not the understanding. The understanding, all that does is help you communicate about what you've learned, because you're engaging your intellect, which is speech. All that's on the same side of the brain. While the other side, the gestalt side, is the one that's being trained. You're training your reflexes on the gestalt side of your brain, the side opposite your intellect. So at least that's the way I do it. You know, the intellect is of minor importance. Understanding is minor. It's the reflexes and the gestalt, the whole picture view that's important. Now, most people have it turned around. They get the theory in school first, and then they go out and get a job, and then they get the experience. But it's still, unfortunately, they're tied. They're anchor weighted. They're shackled. They're bound. They're bound to the training that they got in school because they think anything else, they were told, oh, it is a figment of somebody's imagination, as Groucho Marx would say, and cannot be taken seriously. Well, that's not true. We have what's called commerce, and commerce decides. And we have the military as a cartel with commerce, and President Eisenhower told us this, so I'm not making it up. And it's because of that union that we have a particular science. And it's not just a question of beliefs. It's a question of a stranglehold on free thinking, thinking out of the box. It does not encourage that because they want us all to be technicians. They don't want us to be scientists. Scientists don't take anything for granted. Not even what they're taught. Not even what I'm telling you. You must not take what I'm saying for granted. That it's false or that it's true. You don't know. You don't know that. I'm sure you think you do, but you don't. It's experience that's the only teacher. And it teaches the other side of the brain. That's the brain that's not the intellect. We cultivate our intellect, hopefully, outside of school. Once we've graduated, we keep cultivating our intellect. But we do tend to become specialists, and that tends to give us a narrow focus. So, you know, when I do the exercises on the simulators, I get, you know, my shocks, you know, but I've been doing it for 5 years. And I get over it because I want it. I want that thrill of having my cherished notions of reality broken and reformulated all over again on some other basis. I want that. I want change. I want progress, and I want it now. I don't want it yesterday. I don't want it tomorrow. I want it now. I'm I guess I run. That's the only thing I hustle. I won't hustle for money, you know. I mean, I don't. I refuse to, especially since I'm 65 years old. I'm not going to hustle for money, but hustle for growth of learning. Oh yeah, give it to me. Give it to me, you know, if I want it, yeah, right? You know, because we can't learn everything, right? But, you know, whatever I'm focusing on, and I have to give it to myself. That's the other thing. Nobody else can give it to me. I have to understand. I have to own the knowledge. And I can only own it if I experience it. So anything Eric Dollard has said, or Jim Murray, or Aaron Murakami, or Peter Lindemann, John Bedini, all these people, it's nice, but I still have to own it, which means I have to understand it, which means I have to experience it. That's the core. That's the root of the tree, is experience. If you don't have experience, you can forget it. You don't know nothing. You've got a belief, is what you've got. But if you own an experience, you may not know what you experienced, but that doesn't matter. You know you had the experience. Now, we've had plenty of movies where the guys get their worldview shattered, and after the experience passes, they go, oh, it never happened. You know, I'm thinking of the movie Michael with John Travolta. One of the guys is a newspaper reporter for a tabloid, and he said, no, we didn't see an angel. Nah, they don't exist. Nah. You know, but he held the dying angel in his hands, who had come to Earth in a body to do a particular service, was to give that man's heart back to him because he lost his heart. And the character Michael, John Travolta, says it's really a hard challenge to give back to a man the heart that he lost. It's not easy. You can teach yourself whatever you want to and cultivate your intellect, but to give back, to be given back your heart if you've lost it, you know. And we all have had our disappointments in life, and every time we have one, we lose a little piece of our heart. And if we have too much disappointment, we lose just about all the heart, and we figure, well, what's the point of living? And then the person goes and commits suicide. So a heart is pretty important. You know, it beats, you know. So it's pretty important to have a heart on all levels, physical and non-physical as well. You have to love what you do, right? That's a heart. So there's always some heart in everything. You know, some people love to chase money, you know, so they got a heart in something. Mine is I want to chase knowledge. And at the moment, it's electrodynamics. Somebody asked me, Franco asked me, what's my theory of everything? And I had to wait, because I knew I had already talked about it to the extent that I understand, so there was nothing more for me to say. But I'll tack it on to the end of this recording. Consciousness is everything, but the dynamics, the study of the dynamics of consciousness, is the study of electrodynamics. What electrodynamics manages to pull off is it is the interface between space and time. Time extends itself out of itself into the direction of space, in the sense that it makes itself more complicated than simply, you know, forwards and backwards. And in the course of doing so, it what's tacked on or extended from that framework of forwards and backwards time is the four quadrant theory of electricity, according to Eric Dollard. And so the four times the two gives us eight qualities, which are also matching the eight limbs of yoga, Ashtanga yoga, and also the eight trigrams of the Yi Ching. So this is ancient knowledge that's been lost. Its significance has been lost. So I'm telling you the details of it is that it's an interface. Electrodynamics is the interface between time and space so that they can interact. Otherwise, they'd be two separate entities and they'd have nothing to do with each other. But time extends itself into space, creating a fiction, basically. It's all a fiction. It's all a mirage. You know, it's called Maya for a reason. But it's very real when you're in it, especially when you're identifying with the body that's made of it. Because time essentially is always now, and space is always here. So there's really you know, nothing much to be said on that level. But on our level, where everything is changing, this is what happens. It creates an extension of time. So that time bifurcates into past and future, because originally, you know, or essentially, I should say, essentially on one level, it's always now. You know, there's no big bang. You know, it's different levels of reality, and the physical is a very small part of it, and the most chaotic of them all. It's the least orderly. It's the least organized. And trust me, explosions only happen on the material plane. They don't happen anywhere else on any subtle plane, because it's the nature of the physical world to explode. And that's why we came up with the Big Bang, but it doesn't exist in time. There's no event horizon, you know, that the Big Bang happened in time. It's happening all the time. Explosions are happening all the time. It's called reactor power. Anyway, so consciousness is a nice term, but it doesn't tell us much. But it is the fabric of creation. And the dynamics of consciousness is electrodynamics, serving as an interface between time and space. But space did not bring this interface about. It's time that brought it about. Bifurcating and then further bifurcating itself three times in order to create eight principles that go to make up the major factors, the essential factors of electrodynamics. That's my theory of everything, because all matter, gravity, everything comes out of this interface. Everything. There isn't anything that you can say about the material world that is not described by electrodynamics. It's impossible. And that's why I've said before, there isn't a circuit for every problem, except the unforgivable sin. But aside from that, there's a circuit for every problem imaginable. You know, take Wilhelm Reich. He had his orgone devices, and he brought down a UFO. He literally took away the power that that UFO had to stay aloft and caused it to crash, and that's why he was arrested and put in jail and then killed before he was released. And all his books were burned because he used an electric circuit that was powered by the earth on one end of its linear conduit, and at the other end, the other terminal of that transmission line, was the UFO that he was pointing at. And he literally, the word escapes me, he defrocked it, you know? He took away its ability to stay aloft. And I can tell you how that works. Every UFO has to create an electrostatic field to harbor the magnetic field that it's going to use to levitate, because it doesn't have any coils to energize. Unlike an electric motor, there are no coils to energize. It just has its environment. So it has to put out this humongous amount of electrostatic charge in its environment, and it's a positive ionization that tends to form clouds. If the air is humid, it'll form a cloud around the UFO. And so he basically grounded it out. He grounded out that positive charge to a moving body of water, and the cloud dissolved. It showed that it had a UFO in the middle, and the UFO came crashing to the ground because it had no power anymore, because the electrostatic field had been grounded out. It had been neutralized. It didn't matter, you know, the magnetic field it was putting out to levitate, because it was useless. It was being dissipated, see? So the magnetism was being dissipated and useless because it had no electrostatic field to harbor it, to give it safe haven, to disallow it from being dissipative. You know, you don't want the magnetism to dissipate, because that's what it always does, and then you get distortion because the magnetism always wants to dissipate. But so the UFO was using electrostatics to preserve the magnetic field, so that it could do what it does, you know, right angle turns, stop on a dime for immediate acceleration without any sense of inertia, you know. So anyway, so or change in inertia, I should say. So that's a circuit, even though it's powered not by a battery. It's still a circuit. You know, he's got conduit pipes, you know, metallic pipes, and he's got the earth as a ground underneath the moving water. And then he's got the moving water, which is a mechanical current of sorts, because you've got ions, you know, all those water molecules are ions. And so he's charging up the ions, and they're going past the back end of his tubes. Well, actually, he had tubes, and then he has a flexible metallic conduit to go down from the back end of the tube down into the moving body of water. So he's deionizing the ionized electrostatic cloud surrounding the UFO. That's what he's doing. And he's using a pointing device to do it, long tubes. And maybe there's certain lengths and dimensions and proportions, you know. But regardless, that's what he was doing. And the water was carrying it away. And this same principle was used by Richard Hackenberger when he figured out that he's got to get rid of the electrostatic field around the Evie Gray motor because they had an FCC raid because they were disturbing their environment and disrupting radio reception and whatnot. So they had a raid, and they had a few motor models left in storage that the FCC didn't know about. So they brought them out of storage, and so he worked on it. And so he learned he had to compress air and blow it through the interior of the motor. And then he had to do other things as well to create a capacitant situation so that it would be focused on the inside of the motor and thus not broadcast it outside itself. So it could be focused and then blown out. And then the ions of air could ground themselves to nearby objects, walls, tables, floors, people. But it wouldn't be hanging in the air anymore because it wasn't being broadcast anymore. So it's the same principle as Wilhelm Reich. But see, Wilhelm Reich was using a circuit. An orgone circuit, but a circuit nonetheless. And, you know, using the natural energies of the earth in addition to the artificial energies of the UFO, all combined into one operation. And the simplest of things. So this is how we have to think in order to think about this stuff. We have to get so skillful, so comfortable with the knowledge that we're able to simplify things down to their utter, utter simplicity. And only then do we really have a grasp on what's going on. Otherwise, we're still groping. And I know the feeling when I'm groping. I feel, I'm not convinced, you know. I really understand this, you know. But once it gets simplified, it really starts to click. All right, does that help? Let me dwell a little bit more, just one more time, on gravity. And then I'll shut up. Our cherished notion of gravity, we extend it to all matter, and it's false. Matter does not have intrinsic gravity, per se, of any remarkable degree. In other words, it's not based on the mass, per se. Gravity is like an electromagnet. It's an organization of energy that's there, but it's organized to function a certain way, so that it becomes obvious that it's there because, you know, when you have a piece of magnetizable iron that has not been magnetized, we don't know the magnetism is there. We don't notice it unless it comes under the influence of another magnet. But by itself, we wouldn't know it. So like that, gravity is everywhere that's true as a potentiality only. And it does not become activated, unless it comes within the dominant, the sphere of influence of a celestial object. And when I call a celestial object, I don't mean cosmic dust or rocks. I mean planets and stars, you know, things that are spheroidal. They have a structure and a function. They're a machine. They are not a hunk of rock. Now, one of the moons of Jupiter literally looks like a hunk of rock. But all the other moons are spheroidal. So this is what we fail to realize because we've been living on the Earth all this time, and so we're programmed to think that, oh, it must be a quality of all matter. In potential, yes, but in activation, no. In order to be actualized, it has to become functional, and that's where electrodynamics comes in and describes the functionality of gravity. Somehow, I don't know how exactly, but it's pretty obvious if a UFO uses electrodynamics to stay aloft or to submerge itself underwater, then yeah, it's got to be electrodynamic. It kind of goes without saying, you know, without going any further. Anyway.